Hi, this is Christopher O'Reilly, host of From the Top. Thank you for tuning into this week's podcast. While this podcast is free for all of you, it actually costs our little nonprofit some significant resources to purchase rights for all this fabulous music. Please consider making a small gift to From the Top and keep us broadcasting loud and clear. Go to fromthetop.org and click on Support.
Today, zoology and entomology meet the classical guitar. We'll hear from a 17-year-old who's been kissed on the cheek by Jane Goodall and has a job at a research lab painting ants. Yes, painting ants. From NPR, it's From the Top, celebrating the power of music in the hands of America's kids. We're at Centennial Hall at the University of Arizona in Tucson, where we'll also hear a 14-year-old pianist play Prokofiev and an 11-year-old violinist play Debussy. From the Top's home is New England Conservatory, where outstanding young artists and inspirational teachers are transforming classical music. Here's our host, the great concert pianist, Christopher O'Reilly.
Thank you. Thank you and welcome, everybody. We're so grateful to UA Presents, the performing arts presenter at the University of Arizona, Tucson, for bringing us here. We're in Tucson at a very special time of the year. The largest gem and mineral show in the world is just winding down to make way for the Fiesta de los Vaqueros Rodeo Week, with the rodeo parade and the Tucson Rodeo, which brings thousands of cowboys and horses to town. We've been doing our own kind of wrangling here in Tucson, rustling up two terrific local classical musicians, the 14-year-old pianist and the zoology-obsessed guitarist Joanne mentioned. But let's start with an amazing 11-year-old violinist who's from a place where they don't know from swallows or prickly pears. She comes from New York City. Please welcome Ellie Choi. Ellie, welcome. Tell everyone what we're going to play together.
We are going to play the first movement of Debussy's Violin Sonata in G minor.
When you're ready, we'll take it from the top. Thank you. Ellie Choi, 11-year-old violinist from New York City, performing the first movement of Claude Debussy's last composition, the Sonata for Violin and Piano in G minor. Ellie is one of our Jack Kent Pick young artists. Well, I'm glad we waited for that, Ellie. We have not played that on the show ever. So clearly, we were waiting for you to be born and play that beautiful Debussy as beautifully as you did. So
thank you.
Thank you. It's good to plan ahead, isn't it? Ellie, there's a Korean tradition for children that may have influenced your decision to pick up the violin. It happens when you're 1 year old. What happens?
Yeah, for your one-year-old birthday, Korean parents, they set out objects that kind of reflect the child's future. It's like a thread, because a thread is very long. It's for a long life. And rice is for being rich. And a piano is for being a pianist. And my mom, she was a pianist herself. I think that's why she put a piano there. There was also a violin and a pencil for an author and all those kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And I picked up the violin. So I think that kind of reflected how I was going to be in the future, and I really enjoy it.
Well, I'm glad you do. We certainly do. Now, you moved with your mom from your hometown of San Diego to New York to study at the Juilliard Pre-College Division. Tell the story about the strange performance experience you had that could only happen to someone your age.
Since they have baby teeth and they have to, like, they have to grow into new teeth, big teeth. And that time, one of my molars were really wiggly in the morning. I went to the dentist a few days ago, and he wanted me to take it out, but I really didn't, because I have really bad experiences with dentists pulling my teeth out. I don't like that.
No.
And so I was just waiting for it to fall out. And then the day of the performance, in Juilliard, almost every other week, you have a kind of a mini recital with your classmates and your studio teacher, and you just kind of play if you think you're ready. And that day, my teeth, like the molar, was kind of like, it was about to fall out. But I just kept it in because I wanted to take it out maybe later or somewhere when it was less risky. But for the performance, I was playing Viettong number 5 and the first movement, and it was kind of acrobatic, and there's lots of fast parts.
Very intense.
Yeah, and in the fast parts, I clenched my teeth, and it fell out. It was, like, in my mouth, and then it was about into the end. And then I could feel blood. It was kind of going with the pulse of my music. And then in the end, it fell out, and then everybody started laughing.
Oh, my gosh. I'll never listen to Viettong 5th the same way ever again. Sort of the Tarantino Viettong concerto there. You've had amazing performance opportunities all over the world, Ellie. You've played in Austria, in Prague, and even in Dubai. What was that like, playing in Dubai?
In Dubai, I played Paganini Concerto No. 1. But for that day that I played at the tallest building in the world, it's, like, really tall.
What's it called again?
It's called Burj Khalifa.
Burj Khalifa, again.
I think now called Burj Dubai.
Okay.
But it's just really big and really tall. And the elevators were really fast. So
and
my ears started popping
and
and everything.
Wow.
And then the conductor, he managed to take a little string orchestra and like kind of arrange a spot in the sightseeing area. And the string orchestra...
At the top floor.
Yeah, at the top floor. And the string orchestra played, I played, and then finally we had time to see it. Like, we didn't even see it. We were just starting to play. And so there's this special place in the observation deck where you can touch the clouds, quote unquote.
Because you're above the clouds at that point.
Yeah. But I was really disappointed because clouds aren't those puffy white things you see from the ground. They're just water vapor.
They're not made of cotton?
No.
Oh. I'm so disappointed. Gosh, that's an experience none of us have had. I know your mom travels with you. She's a musician too, right?
Yeah, she studied piano in Berlin for 13 years, and I think she really enjoys it. She plays with me sometimes, but recently I've been playing with other pianists, and yeah.
Well, I know you're very, very close to her. What is your absolute favorite thing about your mom?
I love how she smells. Lots of people like how their mom smells, but I just like the natural aura of her, and I think it's really lovely.
I think that's great. I think you probably have a good deal to do with how she smells so great. I think you've got sort of the same biology there, Ellie, and I think your aura and her aura have intermingled, and all of our auras are the richer for it.
Thank you.
All the best to you, Ellie. Ellie Choi, 11 years old, our violinist from New York City.
Podcasts of From the Top are available every week at fromthetop.org. From the Top is made possible in part by the Jack Kent Cook Foundation, advancing the education of students of exceptional promise who have financial need. On the web at jkcf.org. Chris.
Thanks, Joanne. Our next young performer is also a Jack Kent Cook young artist. He's an outstanding 16-year-old trumpet player studying at the Interlochen Arts Academy in Michigan. His name is Elmer Churampi Mucha. Elmer, tell everyone where home is.
I'm from Lima, Peru.
And so there you are studying in the Michigan winter. You must miss Lima's weather as well as your family.
Yeah, I miss home so much.
Well, to help ease your feelings of homesickness, we wanted to let your parents listen in on your performance today. So we've got your mom and dad on the line from the Republic of Peru. Say hello to them.
Hello.
Hello.
Hello, ma.
Bien, acá esperando el momento en que tú te presentes a tocar ahí, papi.
Sí, aquí estoy en la radio, acá hay mucha gente.
Entonces, what's mom say?
Para mí también es una emoción muy grande que estés ahí.
Okay. She said, I cannot wait to hear you.
Okay, Dora and Elmer Sr., you all sit back and listen. And Elmer Jr., please introduce this terrific arrangement we're going to play together.
I will play Rhapsody in Blue by Gershwin. Thank you.
Elmer Chirompi Mucha, 16-year-old trumpet player from Lima, Peru, now studying with Ken Larson at the Interlochen Arts Academy in Michigan, playing George Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue, arranged for trumpet and piano. Elmer's parents have been listening in from Lima, Peru. Elmer asked them what they thought.
Hello, mamá.
Hello, hijo.
¿Qué te pareció? Dice.
Me pareció muy increíble, hijo, y estoy muy alegre, muy contenta por todos los logros, hijo.
Oh, she said she really liked it, and she thought it was incredible. Yeah.
Now say goodbye to mom and dad for us.
Bueno, mamá, me tengo que ir. Hello?
Benito, quédate, siga viendo muy bien.
Bye bye.
Elmer, I know your father is a trumpet player too, a salsa player. Did he get you started on the trumpet?
Yeah, when I was 4, I took his trumpet when he was going to take a break. And I just played it for fun, and I got a good sound. I remember I played a C. This one. That one, yeah. And
You picked it up at 4 years. I mean, so in other words, he didn't get you started. You
no,
just took
yeah,
it.
I just took it, yes. I don't know why.
Wow.
And from that day, he told me that I was going to be a trumpet player, and he started teaching me from that day.
I think he's right. And you became a fantastic player very quickly. You won first place in auditions to attend the National Conservatory of Peru. And then, as soon as you arrived at Interlochen, you won first chair there. But I know you had a lot of help along the way. For example, you were given your first concert instrument by a soccer star in your home country. How did that come about?
This famous soccer player, his name is Norberto Solano. He used to be the captain of the professional soccer team from Peru. And so I was trying to find help for my flight tickets to study in the United States and to find new trumpets. So the TB people helped me to find this famous soccer player, and he promised me that he was going to give me. So he gave me the flight tickets and these new trumpets. So it was fantastic, and I still remember him like as a good friend. Yeah.
Very moving. And I know many others have helped you along the way, but you've helped your sister out back in Lima. How do you help your sister?
Yeah, her name is Camila. She's 5 years old now. She was born with some problems in her lips. And in Peru, when I go every summer, I need to make gigs playing weddings so I can support my family paying her therapies. So I need to help my family to pay my sister's school. So I started working as a trumpet player there when I was 14, maybe. So because I have a family very humble and poor. So I want to change this in the future, but for now I'm doing gigs in Peru, helping them, supporting them.
Well, my gosh, you know, some of us would be saving our money for an Xbox or something.
Right,
and there
yeah.
you are helping with your sister's medical bills and therapy.
Right.
Gosh, you're to be heartily blessed, Elmer, and you're clearly blessed with a wonderful family and a great gift. We're very privileged to have had you on the show.
Thank you.
The best to you.
Thank you.
Elmer Chirompi Mucha, 16 years old, a trumpet player from Lima, Peru, now studying at the Interlochen Arts Academy in Michigan. Our first local performer of the day joins us now. Please welcome from here in Tucson, 17-year-old guitarist Augustus Woodrow Tomizuka. Augustus, may I call you Gus?
Sure thing, Chris.
Very good. Tell everybody about this piece you're going to perform.
This piece is the Grand Overture by Mauro Giuliani, Opus 61 for guitar, and I absolutely love it, and I hope you do too. Thank you.
Augustus Woodrow Tomizuka, 17-year-old guitarist from here in Tucson, performing Grand Overture by Mauro Giuliani. Gus, I heard the overture, but I heard the whole opera. I've never heard such a grand evocation on the classical guitar. I mean, I heard the basso profundo and the basso buffo and the Heldon tenor and everything. I mean,
I'm glad you got it too.
Oh God, the differentiation of voices is just extraordinary.
Thank you.
The character
Thank you.
That you bring to it, and really just had us all enthralled.
I try.
You do very, very well. Gus, you say that Tucson here is the epicenter for classical guitar.
Absolutely, without a doubt. I think Tucson, because we're kind of the gateway to South America, we have a huge Latin influence, and because of all this cultural diversity, we get a lot of people here, as I'm sure a lot of the people in this audience are tonight, who are really into Latin American culture, and as you know, guitar is a huge part of that culture. So people who come here, are guitar just goes over really well in the local community. And as a result, we have a fantastic program at the University of Arizona headed by Tom Patterson. And we have people like David Russell and the Assad brothers who come here every year. It's really fantastic. Best place to study.
So you've got to work with all kinds of people and hear all kinds of people in your...
Yeah. The audition tape I actually sent in was from a masterclass with Odair Assad, which was crazy.
It's true that you're an outstanding musician, but tell everybody, you've got a real passion for something else.
Yeah, I'm really into conservation and zoology and natural history. That's my other side.
Well, I wanted to learn more about your other side, so I asked you to take me to a lab where you have an internship. We're at the Dornhaus Social Insect Lab at the University of Arizona, and Gus, what the heck are you doing?
So I'm sitting here painting ants. So what we do, we mark ants individually with different color codes using paints that are actually designed for race cars. And this allows us to go into a colony and identify individuals specifically and kind of track their movements over a long period of time. So right here I have a worker, and she's running really fast, and this is kind of the most skilled portion.
Oh, you got
there
her.
There you go, yeah.
You got her. And now you're putting her on ice. I was hoping that was for chilled tequila shots later. But no, is that to slow her down?
Yeah, exactly.
I used to read a lot of sociobiology, Conrad Lorenz. Conrad Lorenz on aggression and King Solomon's Ring. And so, of course, that was all about insects and other species in sort of mass mentality, and now here we are getting into the individuality of ants. Is that something new?
Yeah, actually, interestingly, it's kind of at the same time as we're getting more interested in studying ants as individuals, we're also really, the scientific community as a whole is still really interested in studying what we call the superorganism, so mm-hmm. kind of the colony mm-hmm. as a whole and how that behaves. So I don't know. There are kind of the two aspects of studying social insects that both come into play, really. Mm-hmm. And this actually, it's interesting because people didn't used to think that individual ants would behave very differently. But our research so far, which is was started by Dr. Scott Powell, who's an incredible mentor.
He's your mentor here.
Yeah, an ant researcher. Our research is really aimed at identifying maybe behavioral differences between individuals within a colony, which was previously not really thought of too much. I mean, we do a lot of other things too, but that's one of the goals.
Gus, this internship at the insect lab is just one of the things you've been doing with animals. You're a volunteer at the zoo also, yes?
Yeah, that's right. I've been a volunteer at the zoo since just before my freshman year of high school.
So what do you do there? Do you give tours? Do you educate? What do you do?
I help out on some tours. Education is the primary part. I'm also certified to handle smaller education animals, but I'm good with insects, not so much with larger animals. You know, I don't know.
I think you're a little bit modest about your experience with large animals. Tell everybody about this amazing experience you had in the Arctic.
Yeah, so back in 2010, there's this organization called Polar Bears International, and the zoo that I volunteer at is what's called an Arctic ambassador, which means they're closely affiliated with Polar Bears International. So... Mm-hmm. Because of this, they got a slot for one of the teen volunteers to travel to Churchill, Manitoba, which is pretty much the number one polar bear viewing site in the world, and do some research and conservation. They hosted an essay competition to get the position, and I was actually too young at the time, so I wasn't going to do it, but my mom, who's very strong-willed, influenced me to try, and they told me I got it, which was ridiculous.
That's fantastic.
Right. It was unbelievable. I mean, it's a life-changing experience because I liked polar bears before, but I had no idea how diverse they are as a species and their habitat is.
Explain to me how you got so close to a polar bear. You were in some sort of gondola or what was it?
You have to ride around on what are called tundra buggies, and they're like massive school buses on steroids, and these allow you to go out there and get right up close, and they have a back deck that's open. And some of the more curious bears will actually come up right up to the deck.
And you were about as close to one as you and I are right now?
Yeah, about that close. Yeah, and I mean, I did have the higher position, so mm-hmm. I felt pretty much safe. But I mean, she breathed on me, and that's a really life-changing experience when you have a polar bear breathe on you.
Gus, tell the story of the donation you got to hand over to a very famous primatologist.
Yeah, so We were lucky enough at the zoo to have primatologist Jane Goodall, who a lot of people are familiar with, come in. And at the end, I was informed by Vivian Van Peenen, who runs the Reed Park Zoo, that we had raised some money for the Jane Goodall organization. And she offered me the opportunity to present it to Jane Goodall. And, you know, of course, it took me maybe one microsecond to determine that that would be a fantastic option. And so, yeah, so after she was done giving this lecture, some other teen volunteers and I went up and I handed her the check, and I don't want to quote how much it was, but it was substantial. And you know, I kind of shook her hand. I was like, it was really surreal. And then she kissed me on the cheek, and I always said, you know, I will never wash that cheek ever again.
I'm so inspired by talking with you and watching you paint these ants. It's such a great experience. Thanks for bringing us to the lab. Totally fascinating.
No, thank you very much. It's been my pleasure.
Gus, make sure you pass along our thanks to everyone at the lab for letting us come and visit and not let the bees out and stuff like that. I have one question for you. Do you ever sleep?
Quite a bit, actually. You'd be surprised.
I'm very surprised. Here you are, you know, mastering the animal kingdom, the insect world, and the guitar to such a degree. My gosh, my hat's off to you.
Thank you.
You're such
much.
An inspiration. Great.
Thank you very much, Chris.
Thanks, Gus. Augustus Woodrow Tomazuka, 17 years old, from here in Tucson, Arizona.
Being in the audience for a From the Top taping is an unforgettable experience. We tape shows all over the country, and this May 19th we'll be in Princeton, New Jersey, taping our radio program with the American Boy Choir. For tickets, info, and our entire national tour schedule, go to fromthetop.org.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from U.S. Trust, believing that the arts have a worth all their own in stimulating the hearts and imaginations of our country's best young musicians. From the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need, on the web at rwjf.org. And from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. This is NPR.
From NPR, it's From the Top, celebrating the power of music in the hands of America's kids. This week, we're coming to you from Centennial Hall at the University of Arizona in Tucson. Coming up, a gifted 15-year-old cellist from the Chicago area performs the music of Alexander Glazunov. From the Top's home is New England Conservatory, where outstanding young artists and inspirational teachers are transforming classical music. Our show in Tucson is made possible by Shirley Chan and Wally Prowicki and Dr. Herschel and Jill Rosenzweig. Special thanks to Classical 90.5 and Arizona Public Media. Here again is Christopher O'Reilly.
The actor David Hyde Pierce became a household name when he played the role of Niles on the long-running TV series Frasier. But he's also a Tony Award-winning theater actor appearing on Broadway in musicals like Spamalot and Curtains. Currently, he's starring in the latest play by Christopher Durang, Vanya and Sonia and Masha and Spike. But what you may not know is that growing up, David was completely devoted to classical music. All through high school, he was planning on becoming a concert pianist. So when I found out he was a fan of our show, I decided to give him a call. How did you start piano? You were actually a concert pianist in the making until you got into college. What age did you start, David?
I started playing when I was about 8 years old. My teacher was a wonderful old French woman named Edith Stonequist, and mm-hmm. her mother taught at the Paris Conservatory. And Mrs. Stonequist would tell me stories of being a little girl and sitting under the stairs at their house and listening to Alfred Cortot play in their home. So even though I was completely an amateur pianist, here I was sort of having this connection with some very serious musicianship. And also my hometown, Saratoga Springs, not only had Skidmore College, but when I was a little boy, I think when I was about six or so, they built a big performing arts center there, which became the summer home of the Philadelphia Orchestra and the New York City Ballet.
Mm-hmm.
So the kind of cultural quotient in the city went up, even though I had the advantage of growing up in a small town and knowing all my neighbors and all of that, being able to walk to school. Also, there was this incredible influence of arts and specifically music.
Mm-hmm. So how about your relationship with the piano? I mean, did you love the instrument? Were you practicing assiduously as a child?
I can tell you that for exactly 1 year, I hated every second of it. And my mom and dad made me keep taking lessons. And mm-hmm. then something clicked at the end of the first year. I discovered two things happened. One, I discovered that I was a good sight reader. So once that I had enough training to be able to read music, suddenly I found I could play through things and actually play for enjoyment rather than just forced labor. Mm-hmm. So that was a big turning point. But the other thing that really, I think, kept me engaged as a young person playing is my teacher, as I said, was very skilled and very steeped in great music and great music training. But she wasn't what I would say someone who was meant to train virtuosi, mm-hmm. people who were going to go on to a career. What she was meant to do was instill a great love of music. Mm-hmm. So what would happen is I'd be watching, say, on PBS, they'd have a silent movie playing, and there would be this music, piano music playing under the silent movie. And I would go to my piano teacher and I'd say, now what is this? And I'd play a little something, and it turned out to be Beethoven's Appassionata. And I said, oh, can I play that? And she didn't say, no, what are you, an idiot? She just said, sure. And she handed me the music, and of course she had these beautiful old turn of the last century editions in great editions from Leipzig and Paris. And so they, mm-hmm. even to look at them, they had such character and life in them. And then I would just mangle Beethoven's Appassionata, but find little moments that I could play. And she just always encouraged me that way. I learned a lot of pieces just because I heard them somewhere and said, gee, can I play this? And she said, sure.
Oh, that's great. So encouraging. How about kids your age in school? I know you mentioned your siblings all took piano lessons, but were you the only musical kids on the block? Did your sight reading ability have you as the the music meister of high school plays and things like that, or what happened?
Not exactly. I would say I was probably one of the best young pianists in a small town, and one of the reasons I didn't end up being a concert pianist professionally is when I went to a bigger town, I found out that I couldn't really compete. But along with Skidmore and the Performing Arts Center, we also had in my public high school an amazingly dedicated and vital and sophisticated music program. We had Jeffrey Vredenburg, who directed the chorus, and Alan Dennis, who conducted the orchestra and went on to found Midwest Young Artists.
That's right. We've worked with Alan a lot.
That's right, and they're right outside of Chicago and have done an incredible job of developing this program that reaches thousands and thousands of students, and they have mm-hmm. multiple symphony orchestras and jazz bands and award-winning chamber music groups, which is a testament to Alan and his great love of music and his love of music education. But so there was actually, in my little public high school, a pretty big contingent of people who played music and either sang in the choir or played in the orchestra, and mm-hmm. I spent a lot of time accompanying, usually instrumentalists, sometimes singers, but mainly instrumentalists then, who would be doing all-state competitions and things like that. I played for the high school and junior high school choir. Mm-hmm. In fact, the way I got hooked into that was that Mr. Redenberg, Jeff Redenberg, the chorus conductor, discovered me one day. I was actually playing hooky from gym. I was skipping gym class. Nobody knew about it. But I was in a practice room because they had these big, gorgeous grand pianos, and I was playing through some music. And instead of saying, oh, you get detention because you weren't in gym, he said, you want to play for the choir? And so I ended up doing that and playing for instrumentalists. And there, so there was a big core of people, not necessarily destined to go into the arts professionally, but people who really loved music.
Yeah, and it sounds to me, and we find this often, it's not a generational thing. It really is a local ethos. I mean, Saratoga Springs, it was probably just in the air and continues to be, as we note.
Yes, I think so, and I think it's so important. And especially important given we're talking about a public school. This wasn't a music school. It wasn't a privately funded, you know, a highfalutin academy or anything. And yet they had a very healthy respect for the arts. I'll always be grateful for that.
So, David, you were listening to a lot of classical music as a teen. Who were your musical heroes of the time?
You know, I have these, you sort of have these events that just are crystallized something, and they stick with you. And I remember one of them for a birthday. I guess I was probably in my early teens, maybe a little bit younger, and I was given a whole bunch of Beethoven. I was given the complete symphonies. I was given the complete string quartets. And one of the things I was given, this is back in the day when things were on records, was the complete piano music of Beethoven, the first time Alfred Brendel had recorded it.
Yes.
And I what I specifically remember was, A, having access to all that music, but B, I would play it, and I kind of liked it. And then one day, my brother got my parents' new stereo. And I can still remember putting the record on, and suddenly the sound of the bass of the piano, the warmth and the richness and the nuance of Brendel's playing, and I was like hit by a thunderbolt. I had no idea that that's what we were talking about when we were talking about piano music. So just by virtue of that, I grew up loving Brendel's playing. I have a lot of current heroes now, but when I was little, he was certainly one of them. Arthur Rubinstein, I love. And then much later on, I came to people like Horowitz and Vyacheslav Richter and those gang. And then, as I say, I have a slew of the people who are playing now who I adore.
David, the kids on our show share stories both about their triumphs and their foibles with us on the show. Were there times for you playing music as a child that stuck out in your memory as perhaps humorously star-crossed or things that make you cringe a little bit? It sounds like it was awfully happy, I got to say.
I had my mix. I remember when I played, when we had piano recitals at my piano teacher's home, she had these two Siamese cats, and they had the run of the house, and they would frequently, while you were playing your recital, hang out on the piano. And sometimes they'd actually walk across the music stand and occasionally swat at the strings while you were playing. So that taught me early on that live performance, you know, anything can happen. And I certainly had, I had a terrible experience. My only experience in competitions, and I had prepared for, this was upstate New York, so it was the Albany Symphony and the Schenectady Symphony, and they each had about the same time concerto competitions. And you were supposed to go in and play a movement of a concerto. And the thing that I'd been working on was the Liszt First Concerto, which is essentially one movement. So what I decided to do was just edit together all the really fast, loud parts, because I was very young and I thought that's what music was all about at the time. And so we did this kind of horrifying hodgepodge of the Liszt Concerto. And I also realized I was better off playing at home with no one listening. Because when there are other people listening, suddenly you realize the notes that you're leaving out, and the notes that you're occasionally hitting that you probably shouldn't be. So ultimately what that led me, it was a very sort of embarrassing experience, although the judges were very sweet to me. But for myself as a musician, what ended up becoming true was that I developed a lifelong passion for music. I continue to play and practice to this day. But I realized that my real love of the piano at that time as a performer was performing. The idea of performing, which is what ultimately led me to acting. as opposed to being a concert pianist, which I really wasn't equipped to do.
So that was a moment, I understand, really, when you went to Yale, you were still studying to be a concert pianist. And so what happened at Yale exactly?
It wasn't painful. It was a very gradual recognition of two things. One, I auditioned, I played the piano and the organ, and I auditioned on both instruments. And it just became clear to me that the other kids, the other, whatever they were, 18-year-olds now, 17, 18-year-olds that I was with, had just a hugely greater technique, greater, to be honest, just simply accuracy. I was a great sight reader, so I wasn't that interested in really spending all the time in practice rooms to perfect things. I would hear the piece in my head, but I wasn't hearing what I was actually playing. And I learned from a much later piano teacher how important it is to actually hear what you're creating, because it makes a difference.
Right.
So on the one hand, there was that. There was also, there were so many requirements to be a music major, of courses that I didn't really want to take. But I found that if I weren't a music major, I could still take lessons. I could still take some of the courses, music courses that I wanted to take. And this other thing that I had been doing, which was acting on the side just for fun, I had a small part in a play in my freshman year, and the head of the theater department came up to me afterwards and said, "Boy, you're really good." And I thought, that's weird. I had almost no lines. I didn't think I was doing anything. So those two things where I thought, gee, I don't feel like I have a big contribution to make as a pianist, but apparently this thing that I've been doing just because I enjoyed it, maybe there's something there. So that was how, so it was nice. It was a dovetailing of letting go of music as a profession while I was discovering this whole new world.
Mm-hmm. David, you've been a hugely prolific actor, most recently with your work in theater. Is Vanya and Spike still up and running, going well?
Yeah, well, that's actually, this is a place called Vanya, Sonia, Masha, and Spike, which is a very funny comedy by American playwright Chris Durang, and we did it off-Broadway at Lincoln Center, and now are on Broadway at the Golden Theater, so which is great because it's a very tight-knit group of actors. We loved the play, we loved each other, and we really didn't want to say goodbye to it, so we're happy that it's moving on.
Yeah. What sort of role does piano or classical music play in your life these days?
It's a constant part of my life. I practice every day. I enjoy and understand practicing more, I think, now than I did when I was younger. I'm constantly going to concerts, or even better, I have a dear friend who used to be a manager of classical musicians, and he knows everybody. And I'm performing in a show at night, so I can't go to concerts, but he'll bring me to a rehearsal, which I like even more. So I've seen Yevgeny Kisin and Stephen Hoff and Jean-Yves Thibaudet and who else? All these wonderful artists, and Manny Axe and Richard Good, Jeffrey Kahane and Jeremy Dank, all these great people in rehearsal as well as performance. And that's very exciting.
It's exciting on both ends, I must say. I was in Minneapolis and Ian McKellen was doing Richard III there, and I was playing Bartok III with the orchestra and was at a cafe after rehearsal and all of a sudden see this looming shadow over me saying how much he enjoyed the rehearsal.
isn't that great?
It's quite a thrill
ends. It's nice to hear that it works both ways. But it's, So I continue. And I'll tell you something else I learned. After I finished with Frasier, I came back to New York, where I had been for many years before that, doing theater, and I started doing musicals. And I discovered doing sort of big dance numbers in a musical, learning how the body had to move in space taught me so much about how to play the piano. About sort of there's that constant back and forth between vertical motion and horizontal motion, and that is the essence of dance as well. And so that's the other way that the piano, and I also think my experience as a musician, my experience playing with instrumentalists and vocalists, has led to my appreciation of acting as chamber music, as a kind of ensemble playing, which we certainly had on Frasier, which I have in this current play, Vanya and Sonia. And it's something that I always look for in a in a play or in a musical, that feeling of people with all these different voices all coming together to create one piece of music.
Brilliantly put. Thanks so much, David. Would you do us the honor of introducing the young pianist who's up next on the show?
Yes, absolutely. And now it gives me great pleasure to introduce from Tucson, Arizona, 13-year-old pianist Cameron Williams.
Great to have you on the show, Cameron. And for those of you who would like to check out my full conversation with David Hyde Pierce, please visit us at fromthetop.org. Cameron, how old are you?
I'm 14 years old.
And what are you going to play for us?
I'm going to be playing a piece by Prokofiev, Suggestion Diabolique, Opus 4, Number 4.
Cameron Williams, 14-year-old pianist from here in Tucson, playing Sergei Prokofiev's Suggestion Diabolique. Cameron, you are clearly an evil child.
Thank you, that's a great compliment.
We'll have to rename you Damien or something. That was spectacular. Really great. Cameron, you have a great self-deprecating sense of humor, and in that vein, you describe yourself unabashedly as a bit of a nerd. Now, I know that you know that we celebrate nerds pretty much every week on our show, so I say bring it on. One thing about you that's nerdy, in addition to your wonderful bow tie, I might say, is you're an academic whiz kid. How many languages do you speak at your young age?
Well, I'm currently learning Russian. I speak English, German, and Mandarin. My German's fading a little as I learn more languages, and I'm in the process of learning Russian. Additionally, I took a year of Latin when I was in sixth grade.
And you're a science nerd, too. I hear you like physics best. Is that what you like most about science?
That's right. I am currently listening to some lectures on YouTube by a professor from MIT.
And you got a really cool Christmas present.
That's right. So when most kids, you know, were getting their new video game systems, I got a book by Newton, really old book, The Principia, Mathematical Principles of Natural Philosophy. It's super tough to read.
If it's tough for you to read, Cameron, I'm totally cowed. I'm so glad that you freely embrace your nerdhood. But Cameron, wouldn't it be great to know just how nerdy you are?
Sure.
Good thing to know. You'd be willing to take a test, for instance?
Okay.
All right, Joanne?
I'm up for it.
Okay, here we go. Now, since you're a nerd and a pianist, isn't that redundant?
Hey.
You should be able to get this. Now, which of the following is clearly the coolest thing about the piano? A, that even though it's a percussion instrument, it's capable of the most profound melodic expression. B, that octaves on the modern piano are tuned slightly wider than a 2-to-1 harmonic ratio depending on the overtones of the strings involved based on their length and thickness. Or C, that you can glimpse the human soul through a Shostakovich prelude.
I'm going to have to go with B.
B, obviously. The way octaves have to be stretched in order for the piano as a whole to sound in tune, especially at the lower and upper ends of the piano, way cool. But it's impossible to explain further if you're not a nerd, so you all have to go to Wikipedia for more information.
Okay.
But never look at the actual Wikipedia article. Always go to the citations, because they have the best info.
Right you are.
Okay, he's good. So that one was about thinking like a nerd, but do you know how to look like one? Which of the following is not a nerdy accessory? A, is it a pin that says counting in binary is as easy as 1, 10, 11? B, a 40-gig thumb drive on a carabiner swinging from a belt loop? C, ear gauges? Or D, white New Balance tennis sneakers?
Those are some pretty heavy fashion accessories for a nerd.
The one thing I don't have is C, ear gauges.
Ear gauges, which is the correct answer.
Wow.
Which are, in case you don't know, those are those circular things you put in your earlobes to stretch them. The only gauge a nerd might sport would be a pressure gauge, I would imagine.
And the force down on your ear is mg.
That's right.
9.8 times the mass of the ear gauge.
Thank you, doctor.
He's measuring high on the nerd scale.
Yeah, definitely.
All right. Let's see if you know a bit of nerd history now. The great mathematician and cosmologist Stephen Hawking is a hero to all nerds. Now, through his years of research, he's explained many of the universe's most mysterious phenomena. But which of the following phenomena does he find himself completely unable to explain? Is it A, the paradox that black holes somehow emit photons, neutrinos, and other subparticles? B, the meaninglessness of the concept that there is a beginning or end to our universe? Or C, women?
I think my strategy of going with, you know, how I sympathize worked last time. Mm-hmm. I don't have ear gauges, so I'm going to go with C.
Women. Yes, Hawking famously once said, women, they are a complete mystery. He's been divorced twice.
Wow, Chris, this boy ranks way higher on the nerd scale.
I think, look up nerd in the dictionary. It's got Cameron's picture in it. Congratulations, Cameron. In today's world, being a nerd is the new cool. Cameron Williams, 14 years old, from here in Tucson.
Sometimes kids send us the most wonderful material when they audition for our show, and Cameron is one of those kids. You can see his fantastic audition video at fromthetop.org. Over the last 5 years, From the Top and the Jack Kent Cook Foundation have awarded well over $1 million in scholarships to talented young musicians who have financial need. We still have more to give. Go to fromthetop.org to learn more. Chris.
We don't often get the chance to hear the music of Alexander Glazunov, the Schumann of the steppes, as I think of him. But our final performer has brought us a beautiful piece of his to end the program. From Chicago, this is 15-year-old cellist Daniel Koller. Daniel, you're from the Chicago area, and you're the son of two major musical talents. Let's start with your dad. Tell everybody who he is.
My father is a triple gold medalist at three major national competitions, the Sibelius, Tchaikovsky, and Paganini. And he is a professor at DePaul University.
He has a name.
Violin. Oh, yeah, Ilya Kalar.
Ilya Kalar.
Ilya Kalar.
And I've had the honor of playing chamber music with him, so give him my best when you see him next. And I know your mom is with you here. She's also a violinist, yes?
Yes, she's a great violinist, and she's an author of a string pedagogy book, which she's releasing this week, actually.
Oh, congratulations to her on that. I know we played together, too. She was in the Syracuse Symphony. We played Brahms Second together. Fantastic. Right. Well, gosh, it's so great to connect with you, finally. It didn't take you long to emerge from the shadow of your parents, however. You've already broken into the world of television. Which show?
America's Got Talent. I was a semifinalist.
Very good. And even though you didn't make the finals, I know they've still been using your footage, your very expressive visage, on some of their advertising, so good for you. You obviously made an impression. Even though you were on that flashy show, you've never been a kid who's played music simply to impress. What sorts of things motivate you when you perform? The connection between you and the audience, for instance.
I just really love to share music, and I feel music is a language which I was born to speak.
I think everyone will agree. You speak eloquently through this wistful piece. Please introduce it.
It's the Alexander Glazunov minstrel song.
Great way to end our show. I want to thank all of our great young performers, and thank you all for listening. This is Christopher O'Reilly. Please join me next week, and now Daniel will take it from the top. Thank you.
From the Top is written and produced by Tom Vagley and Tim Banker, with music producer Tom Vinieri. The tour producer is David Balsam, and the production manager is Elizabeth DeVore. Technical direction by Barrett Ouellette, with David Forbes and John Servies. The executive producers are Gerald Slavitt and Jennifer Hurley-Wales. I'm Joanne Robinson. From the Top is an independent nonprofit organization based in Boston. Our founding partners are New England Conservatory and WGBH Boston. To download an application to appear in our program, visit fromthetop.org.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives, at gatesfoundation.org. From the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. And from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. This is NPR.
Thanks for downloading this week's From the Top podcast. If you liked what you heard, head over to our website, fromthetop.org, where you can listen to every show in its entirety. I'm Christopher O'Reilly. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you again next week.